Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon. Woo! Are you having a good day? Wonderful, wonderful. Well, it's my delight to be here with the amazing JJ Davis. My name is Caroline Webb. I am here sitting in this chair, I think, because the focus of my work over many years has been how to boost performance and well-being at work by using insights from behavioral science, so neuroscience, psychology, and behavioral economics. And as part of that, I used to work a lot with teams and boards to help them be more than the sum of their parts. And in that work, naturally, I had to kind of notice that there weren't that many women. Surprise, surprise. And so I became interested in the difference in the room when there were women and when there were not. And that was my entry into thinking about diversity. JJ Davis is far deeper still in the topic. She's not only got this amazing, huge span of a job in being VP of Global Communications for Dell, but she's, through her whole life, devoted an enormous amount of energy and focus to thinking about how to promote and develop and create a platform for women in business and in entrepreneurship in particular. She's the founder of Dell's Women's Entrepreneurship Network. And that's just one very formal example of the things that she's done throughout her life in a way that have really guided much of, you said, much of the personal passion that you brought to work. So she's going to share with us a lot of stories and a lot of tales of what she's done in her career what she's done in her career, but also to talk about what Dell has done in particular to really boost the diverse perspectives that we know drive good teamwork and the good teamwork that we know drives good innovation. And I'd like to start by asking you,
sure.
How did you get into thinking about this topic in such depth and with such passion?
So hi everybody, thanks for having me. There's a lot of friends in the room I didn't expect to see here, so I'm gonna maybe even talk about you throughout the hour today, but it's so great to be here in one of the new homes of Dell EMC. We'll talk a little bit about the merger of the company and what's been going on over the last year or so, but you know, what I have found, and especially, I've been at Dell 16 years, and especially at Dell, but even before, I found that if you see a problem, you have to be the solution. You can't wait on someone else to fix it. And so when it came to advancing women, whether it was inside the company or through the Women's Entrepreneur Network, which we'll talk about, you just take an idea forward, and if it's backed up by the numbers and the benefit back to the business, then it's almost always, we'll go try that. If it doesn't work, we'll course correct and we'll go do something else. And so we have to be bold enough to bring a big idea forward, backed up by the data to support it, and then go get it done and be scrappy and tenacious and build the team, even if it's kind of, we call it our passion jobs, our night jobs, our part-time responsibility, and then tie it back to the business and incubate an idea until it becomes more formal. So I just kind of always approach things as I see something that I think is important to the company and thereby to society. Our company is all about using technology to advance human potential, and I can't think of a better mission. I want to be part of that.
And what about the baby JJ? I mean, let's talk about, so you're 21, 22. Did you care about this? Did you care about diversity? Did you care about teamwork?
Yeah, I mean, I got my start in politics, and if you think there's no women in corporate America back in the early 90s, there weren't any women in politics in the state of Arkansas where I'm from. And so I found myself staffing the Senate, sitting up front, taking the notes and doing all of that, and looking around the room, and a lot went on during those times that none of the men should have been proud of. I was introduced once in a room about this size full of county judges as Jennifer Flowers, not Jennifer Jones.
Oh.
And when I was 22, I wasn't nearly as witty as I can be now, and I had no comeback to that. So, you know, lots changed, and so maybe it was those experiences, even though, you know, very subtle, not anything like what our moms might have gone through in the 60s and 70s, but enough to know that I didn't see anybody in the room like me. And as a young woman, I knew that I wanted to change that. And I didn't ever think about being a role model to anybody else. I just wanted to get up every day and love what I did and make a difference. And I guess over time, maybe that's just kind of naturally happened.
How did it affect you, feeling like you were the only person, you were the only woman?
Yeah, I mean, I think...
And how?
All it did, I think, was give me more drive. I mean, when we think about the Dell Women's Entrepreneur Network and the work we do, I'm in PR, so my job is to tell stories that ultimately make their way into TV or the news or what have you. And when I talk to reporters, I tell them it's their duty and responsibility to profile women founders to the same degree they do men. And stop asking us, I'm sorry I'm bringing it up, it's my one of my hot buttons, about our kids and how we manage it all, because when do you ask a man about that? Because he has a wife. I always wish I had a wife, but I don't. He's great, and he does do the laundry. But, you know, I don't want to talk about how I do it. I just do. I want to talk about what we're doing to drive change and grow businesses and access capital and start companies that are going to ultimately make a major impact on the world. That's what Michael did. And people want to know how he did it and what his vision was to acquire EMC to become the world's largest integrated technology company in the world. They don't ask him about his four kids and how they're doing and what's going on, unless they're personal friends, of course, and then they do.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, women need to be profiled and talked about, and the stories need to be about the successful businesses we're driving or what we're doing in our companies. And sure, the personal side is interesting and that can come through, but that shouldn't be the first thing we talk about.
So of course I'm asking JJ lots of personal stories about herself. So I hope that's okay. but not about children or about your outfit or whatever, but about the choices that you made that enabled you to make such a big difference at Dell. I mean, how did you actually get, you were interested in diversity. You noticed that in tech, there's so few women. Yeah. How did you actually start to take action to shift things? Yes. What did you do first?
You know, I'll answer that, and then maybe, Carolyn, you can even help us tie some of these examples back into the data and the research that you see, because we talk all about the numbers. How many numbers did we throw out in the introductions over lunch about 45% this and 75% that? We don't have enough women on boards and all that, and it's all true, but I think we know what the problem is and what the numbers say, and so what are we going to do about
doing.
It. That's
yeah.
what we're going to talk about today. But I do think the data is super interesting. So actually, my first job at Dell, I got to work on diversity as my job. So I came from a non-technology background. I had done politics and government affairs and moved into public relations and was in the tech sector and then moved out into cause marketing. So I guess, you know, that's, I never have...
Cause marketing.
I never have been in the nonprofit world, but we helped pharmaceutical companies, for example, raise awareness about disease to help them sell more medicine or whatever it might be, immunizations, or we worked with the state of Washington around an anti-tobacco campaign aimed at teens, that kind of thing. So I was doing that work when I got recruited to Dell and came in thinking I was doing public affairs for Central Texas. We were a 20,000 person company then in Central Texas. It was our largest employee hub. But by the time I got this happens at Dell all the time, is you come in 3 weeks later after being hired and a whole new job is there waiting for you because that was the need of the business. And a mentor of mine, Thurman Woodard, who if anyone is in diversity as a field, you may know him, he had been hired in 99 maybe, I joined in 2000, to start up Dell's diversity practice, and I got to come on as his communications partner and lead our internal and external communications, and we set up all of the company's employee network groups. So when you're in a company of 100,000, now 140,000, you feel really alone sometimes. And so these employee resource groups of people like you can help you feel more connected, and now Dell has more than a dozen of these, and we even have employee resource groups around the environment, the connected workplace, people that are in smaller communities that have things in common so that you can go network and do projects together. So that was my first job. And then as I moved out of diversity into the business, I took all that with me and all those connections and then started up other programs that ultimately impacted the bottom line. Thurman always believed that diversity was not the right thing to do from a societal or political perspective. It was good business, and that was ingrained into the way I thought and ultimately the way Michael runs the company today, and we'll talk about that.
I do, yeah. I mean, actually, let's just take a... So how many of you are actively working in the field of diversity? How many of you are drawn by the word innovation in the title of the session? So your focus is innovation, okay. How many of you are entrepreneurs? How many of you are intrapreneurs, trying to build something within a company? Okay.
And how many of you work at Dell? And if you're legacy EMCers, I'll tell you a little bit about some of our connected workplace initiatives that I hope will start to permeate the company globally that I think you'll be excited to hear about.
But it's interesting. So this point about the business case, there's no doubt. So I was working at McKinsey. I was a partner at McKinsey, and I'd started the leadership practice there along with a bunch of other people. Mm-hmm. And we were doing this sort of leadership development, coaching, and helping teams. And as I say, I got interested in diversity because so often there weren't many women in the room, and it was really different when there was a mix of perspectives in the room. And so started to talk to companies about the fact that this was an interesting issue. And this was going back, 15, 20 years. And they said, yeah, we know it is. Diversity is a really big issue for us, absolutely enormous. And then I'd say, so, what kind of budget do you have to spend on this? Budget? And so there was definitely this sort of question about, well, why would you spend money on this? And then I think a lot of the work that fantastic organizations like Catalyst have done, and even my old firm McKinsey have done in building the business case, has been absolutely crucial, because you do not get action in business unless there is a business case.
That's right.
And those of you who are in the room, you will know, I'm sure, I mean, that the Catalyst work that really stuck in my mind was that work looking at return on sales, return on equity, return on invested capital, and the fact that companies that had more women at the top versus those who had the least, the differences were ranged between 40 and 60%. They were really big.
You heard it talked about by...
Kevin O'Leary.
With Kevin.
Oh, yeah, and then
Absolutely.
There's lots of anecdotal evidence.
And, Michael sits on the board of Catalyst, and Dell is a huge partner of Catalyst. I don't know, Catalyst is here at the conference. I don't know if anyone from Catalyst is here in the room, but they started an initiative a few years ago called Men Advocating for Real Change, or MARC. And Dell was an early adopter, and we had some of the men in our company, VP and above levels, pilot this program.
Yeah.
And, we have a Diversity Action Council. We meet regularly. Michael chairs it, and that's where we come together and do, we call it ops review, operational review. We do it quarterly with him across the businesses. Well, we treat diversity the very same way. Yes, we review the numbers and how we're tracking, but we also bring outside in perspective of what's going on in the market and things we want to do as a company. And rather than just muddle around down in the lower levels, we just go right to him and say, this is something we think we need to do. So Steve Price, our head of HR, and Karen Quintos, who is now our chief customer officer, took this idea to Michael of, let's roll out Men Advocating for Real Change across the company and train every executive man and woman in our company. And I think my microphone, can you guys hear me? Something changed up here with the volume. Okay. And this had never been done before in any company, in any sector, anywhere around the world. And this training is a day-long training. And these are VP and above level executives. So the cost of that alone before you even paid for the training is high. It's 8 hours to do the training. But now it's been rolled out, and what the training does is it helps everyone find and see their unconscious bias so they can start to drive practical change in their lives.
And have you seen a real difference?
Yeah, and it can come in the tiniest form. Like Doug Henry, a vice president at the company, held a lot of phone calls at 7:30 in the morning, because he had global team members in Asia, and he was doing a great job in his mind accommodating them so they weren't on the phone at midnight. But what about all the parents of elementary school kids who had to take them to school? Well, they were right in the middle of carpool and couldn't get into the office or onto the phone, and without breaking law, talking on the cell phone in a school zone, whatever.
Yeah.
So he changed that. And then Jeff Clark, the vice chairman and the executive I work with, he said, look, I grew up in San Antonio, working class family. We worked really hard. I didn't have a lot. And I never even thought as a white man that I was someone of privilege. it opened his eyes to the privilege that he has just automatically walking into a room as a white guy, yeah, versus, you know, someone of a different color or different gender or whatever it might be. And so for Michael to spearhead that from the top down and for the executives to embrace it, and then like Jeff went in and said, I want every manager in my department to have this and I'll pay for it. That's the kind of thing we need to do so each individual can take their own action individually, and then collectively you start to see those things change.
What language did Michael use in talking to the business about this at the beginning?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we all...
To make the business case.
Well, he's Michael. He didn't have to make a business case at all.
I know, he's magical. Said, Let's go do this.
And we didn't have to make much of a business case to him either.
Right.
Because he'd already been through the training with his leadership
right.
team.
Right,
But I think we all know in business we tend to kind of run with people that are like us, and we tend to ask people for things who are in our circle. And we might talk about it a little bit today around the difference between networks and networking. You got to have a network, and that's who you go to when you need to get something done. And if you're only working with people just like you,
yeah,
then you aren't going to have that innovation and diversity of thought. And this training is all about breaking that down and building it back up.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I mentioned that I saw a real difference in groups that had diverse perspectives. And, of course, we're not just talking about gender. We're also talking about just people coming from different backgrounds and different, often different nationalities, different parts of the business. And because of my background in behavioral and cognitive science, I was very interested in seeing how it really was different. You did see groupthink at work when you had people who all had a similar perspective. I don't know how many of you, do you know what the term groupthink is? Yeah, so there was seminal work done by a guy called Solomon Ash, back in the 1950s that showed that, imagine you're in a room and you have four lines in front of you, and one of them is clearly shorter than another. But everyone else in the room is, when they're asked, saying, yeah, yeah, they're the same length. They're the same length. So what happens is that 75% of people are willing at least once to say, yeah, they're the same length, I guess. We're so wired to fall in with the group around us. And we know that we have enormous blind spots when we're making decisions through the biases that we carry with us. As you might know, biases such as confirmation bias and anchoring and these things which mean that our brains tend to go for the simple answer rather than the right answer if it's easy to reach for. What's easier to reach for than saying, yeah, yeah, I agree, if everyone around you is saying the same thing? Mm-hmm. So the quality of debate that was taking place in groups that were not diverse was simply not as good. And the answers and the ideas that they were coming up with were simply not as innovative. And fascinating work done by Linda Grattan at London Business School, looking at what actually drives innovation in teams. And she looked at, they looked at lots of factors and they boiled it down to, it's important to have boundary spanning, so you're pulling ideas from different places. It's important to have psychological safety and self-confidence. Everybody feels bold enough to put their ideas forward. And then that drives transfer of ideas, and it drives experimentation, and it drives higher performance. And they found that when teams had 50-50 men and women, that safety, self-confidence, and experimentation were all higher. And that was what drove higher innovation in teams that were diverse. Have you seen that?
Yeah, and
She has to say yes right now. How does your experience relate to the research? What have you seen that echoes the research?
Yeah, I mean,
in
one thing
work?
You just said that stands out for me certainly is the safety, and as leaders in the room, for anyone who are managers or if you're on a team, you want to make sure you create that safe environment for them, and then make sure that you're failing fast. I mean, that's a common term in the world of startups, is try something, learn from it. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, don't be ashamed of that. Take pride in it and move on. Just don't make that same mistake again. So I try to do a lot of that, is make sure that I create an environment where innovation is welcome. We want to try new things, and we actually reward it, whether it works or not. And I think people respond really well to that. But I will see dynamics in the different personalities, where I have a woman on my team who I asked to spearhead this media opportunity with MSNBC, and it was pretty controversial, and it could go one way or the other. And she was prepping an executive with a guy on our team, and Matt kind of took over and started running with it, and then ultimately he staffed the interview, and at the end of the day, the person I thought was accountable for the result wasn't, and she came back to me and said, well, he just took over, and I just let him, and I didn't stop it. And so that gave me an open door to have a coaching moment with her.
And what did you say?
Well, number one, I said, you should have flagged it for me sooner. It's kind of like back to Kevin's other comment earlier about the phone and always call it. I am always try to be very accessible. But when something is high profile like that and you know it's yours to own, then you have to figure out a way to handle that in the moment, but then also not just let it happen and learn from that and prevent it going forward. But it can happen if you allow it to, and a lot of it just comes down to the different personalities of men and women, and sometimes
the statement.
Men on my team being more aggressive and the women allowing it, and that's something we just have to always work on.
Mm. So different personalities, men and women, that's a big statement.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that there are systemic differences in the way that men and women behave?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the normal stereotypes that you see in business of women being too aggressive and other things, I think that's real, but I don't shy away from that at all. Like, I can hold my own with anyone in a room, and I'm not worried about what people are going to say about it, but I think for some of the more junior women on my team, I have to work with them more to have the confidence to speak up.
Yeah.
And not be bulldozed a bit. You know, I know that is a bit stereotypical. I don't see it happen in the more senior women, but for some of them earlier on in their careers, I think it's something we have to work on a little bit more. But I think a lot of it also comes down to work style, and it's not about gender at all.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not a very organized person. I'm an unstructured thinker. I have big ideas, and I get really bothered when I have to go fill my car up with gas. So I run out of gas all the time, which could come across as me being scattered, which is kind of true. So I build a team of people that are very organized, that make up for where I might have some faults. And
yeah.
And it just so happens that one of them is kind of my right hand, who's a guy, and he just approaches everything very traditionally, and he's very organized and myopic about what he does, and it drives me crazy. That has nothing to do with him being a man and me being a woman. It's just the different work styles, and I think that's as important to the diversity conversation as race or gender or anything else that we might normally pull in. Is you've got to play to your strengths. We were talking about that earlier today, and then surround yourself with people who make up for those areas where you're lacking. And early in my career, I apologized for that. And now, you know, every boss I ever had said, you've got to stop running around with your hair on fire. And I do walk slower now and not run, because
you were running around.
Running around.
Yeah.
And you know, almost puts out this message that, like, my work's more important than yours, and I'm always late, I'm always in a hurry, which means I must be a really important person. So I try to pay attention to that and really calm it down. But even if that's just my personality. And so I now just own it. Everybody knows it about me. But I do pay attention, then I balance that out with people who aren't like that.
So let's go back to the things that you've tried that have, you think, boosted innovation in service of diversity in service of innovation at Dell. Mm-hmm. So you started those circles which allowed innovators to come together. Tell us a bit about how those circles worked in practice.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if we take, so most of the companies that are here in the room probably have some form of an employee resource group or what have you, and you probably volunteer together in the community. One thing we've done on the Dell side with our Women in Search for Real Excellence is our Women's Networking Group. Is we now use that employee resource group almost as our own customer base, because women are making most of the purchase decisions, and so we'll turn to that group of employees when we want to launch a new product and get their thoughts, or when we need to turn a group of women loose to go help us execute something in the marketplace. And so, you know, that was really helpful because we had our own focus group right inside of our own walls, and how, in addition to helping them work together to advance their careers and do career development and community volunteerism, could we take this group of like-minded women who obviously want to connect with each other
other and grow their careers inside the company, but use the power of that on behalf of our customers.
So they were being used as customer focus groups as well as mutual support groups.
Mm-hmm. And so one example, you know, a lot of women in the room are probably in the technology industry, and you've seen all the stats around the lack of women in leadership. And, you know, Intel put out a goal of 50% diverse leaders by a certain year, and we really applaud what they're doing, and they've been very public and loud and proud around their commitment to diversity, and I think that's great. They even brought a diversity announcement around a new fund for their venture group, and they're investing in more women-owned companies, and announced it at the Consumer Electronics Show, which is very different. But we made a conscious decision as a company not to talk publicly about the numbers. Yes, we release them once a year in our annual report to customers, and we're very transparent about what our diversity numbers are, but we're focusing on programs and initiatives that we think will drive change. And it was actually women in our networking group that came together with me and Karen Quintos and others to do something called Role Models. So once a year at Dell World, now Dell EMC World, we bring thousands of customers together for a big technology conference where they hear keynotes and get market information and training and all of these things. Well, every CIO now coming to our executive summit, about 300, they bring a role model from within their IT organization. Melissa, you know about this. Remember when we started a couple of years ago? And the idea was, there aren't very many women CIOs. And rather than talk about the fact that there's only however many percent CIOs that are women, we said to all the CIOs coming to Dell World, mostly men, some women, bring an up-and-coming woman from your organization on our dime. We will host her. She will go to things that you go to. We will do some networking events. We brought in Deloitte, and we did some training on behavioral decision, you know, cognitive science.
You mean you
and
didn't decision making.
I know. I'm sorry. But McKinsey works a lot with EMC, so that probably will change. So, but we brought them all together, and the women had an opportunity to network with each other so they could expand their Rolodex. That's the difference between networking and having a network. And they got all this exposure to their big boss. And they got branded inside their own company as a role model and an up-and-coming female in IT. We brought in journalists to moderate panels, and we talked about not what it's like to be a woman in IT, but we expanded these women into trainings as an IT professional because they wanted to be there first and foremost as an IT pro, not as a woman. But then secondarily, they know they're in the minority. So over time, they start to build this new network. They get exposure with the decision makers. They get some good training. They get to know the Dell executives, they get exposed to all of this information in their field. And this idea came to me and the team from Karen saying, I want a women's track at Dell World. And we said, no, women don't want to be isolated. They don't want to track. They're IT pros. So what started as one idea morphed into something that a woman who is part of our North America WISE organization, took over and ran it. It was her kind of part-time job, and one idea turned into now this big initiative that we'll continue to run, and maybe it does drive change 300 women at a time.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Because that's
300
what it's
out of, what's the
total Well, I mean,
number?
There were 300 CIOs that came to our executive summit, and each of them brought a role model with them.
And how do you think that does spread and make a difference?
I think that when you need your next job now, you have someone to call. Mm. When you're ready to go back in front of that CIO with a big idea, he knows you because you had a glass of wine at that Dell networking event. Or your boss knows that she or he recommended you to the CIO to go along. It's just giving you those moments of opportunity to seize, because you have to ask for what you want. It won't just come to you naturally because you work really hard and you get good results.
So you said a couple of times with some energy that network is not the same as networking. Would you like to tell us why
well,
you care about
the difference?
Well,
you guys
there?
Know you join a women's group and they have a meeting once a month and you go and you put on a name tag and you awkwardly stand around and hope your friend will show up and maybe you exchange and put your business card in a fishbowl and someone's there to talk to you, but you walk out not really sure why you were there in the first place. That's networking. There's a million groups like that where we all join them with this big expectation.
I'm Caroline.
Yes, exactly.
Yes,
what do you
card.
Do?
Yes.
What do I do? And you don't know why
I'm
you're
sure
talking
you have no idea what we're talking about.
Yeah. And so, but then building a network, that's why you go to these networking forums and these groups and you join these things. But having a network is like what Kevin said earlier, when you need something, you call and the other person answers the phone.
Yeah, and it's definitely one of the, so I'm really careful about talking about male-female differences. Indeed, any other type of demographic type of differences across, and you know, people often say, but men's and women's brains are really different, aren't they? It's a very complicated story. But we do definitely know from the research that women do approach building their networks differently to men. That is one of the areas where there's probably least
argument.
What are
the differences?
Well, you definitely see that women tend to have a smaller network with deeper relationships, and men tend to have a broader set of relationships, and it might be shallower. You see that women are more likely, three times more likely to have a network that's almost all women. And that is challenging when you're thinking about senior people in the organization. And we know that mentorship, well, sponsorship is really critical. You need people who are going to bang on the table for you and create opportunities for you, actually step forward and not just say, let me give you the benefit of my advice, but do something to actually create an opportunity for you. So if you don't have senior people who are looking out for you in that more proactive way, you've got a slight challenge.
I want to talk about that for a minute. Hey, we meant to say this earlier. There's microphones. If you guys want to jump up and join the conversation, ask a question, make a comment, don't wait till the end. Just do that and we can answer your questions or engage you in the dialogue as we go. We'll go to you first, and then I want to come back to sponsorship and this idea of building a network.
Maybe this will relate to sponsorship and building a network. Hi, my name's Julie Zupan. And I want to thank you both for your work and for sharing it with us. I'm really interested to hear about it. I'm wondering if you can address how your work around expanding diversity in terms of women in the workplace might extend to expanding diversity for people of color, and including women of color.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah. And that's crucial, because definitely the numbers, when you look at the pipeline for women and the fact that 46% of entry-level employees tend to be women and then it falls down to 19%, the narrowing is far greater for women of color. And absolutely, there is a whole extra level. Go on.
Yeah, I mean, at Dell, when we look at everything, we're looking at diversity of all types. In terms of our employee resource groups, of course, we have those for African Americans and Hispanics and Asians and people with disabilities, et cetera. We are very focused on it, but I think a lot of it also comes down to storytelling and bringing up the stories around the people inside the organization that are like me. And then all of us really feeling that calling and getting involved. So, you know, in our organization, under Thurman's leadership a very long time ago, we went beyond what just might be considered, you know, global diversity in terms of our recruiting, and got very involved in the Black and Hispanic caucuses in Congress, and started working at the national level on issues. When we think about profiling women in our storytelling on the media side, we try to do the same thing when it comes to African Americans and Hispanics. You know, when we do our recruiting, we have a goal of increasing our university hiring by 25% by 2020, because we want to get that right pipeline of talent into the company young and early. And there is a very heavy lens toward diversity on that, and we do a lot of recruiting at historically Black colleges and other things. You know, one thing I'll also say is Dell has a very progressive, what we call, connected workplace initiative. So, you know, we, at a time when many other tech companies are reversing this progress, in my opinion, and driving a butts in seats culture, we are actually expanding it and saying we don't care where the talent is. They don't have to be in Boston or Austin. If you're the right person and you're in Atlanta, where maybe there's a higher percentage of diverse talent, stay in Atlanta because that's where your family is, but we want you on our team.
So do people work remotely? How does it work?
Yeah. And that doesn't just mean work from home. It means flexible work. So you could work remotely from Atlanta.
Yeah.
Or like me, you could decide one day a week when you can, you work from home because you have three little kids and you want the flexibility. Our Melissa worked in Austin, has been with the company 17 years. And she's with us and continuing to give back and move up in the organization because 7 years ago, she had a life event and needed to move back to Boston, and the company said, I don't want to lose you, so go. Now we merge with EMC, and she's right back at it here in a city where we have an extremely large presence. So it's no one thing. You have to look at the numbers, and you have to measure it, and you have to treat it like an ops review, just like you would revenue and margin and P&L performance, and then you hope to see the numbers move in the right direction with the right level of investment, and you hope that the sum of the parts equals more than the whole.
And if you, I mean, if your workforce does not match the demographics of the population, you are missing talent.
Absolutely.
You're missing.
And then, you know, you look at even on the entrepreneur side, the amount of venture capital money going into women-owned firms is like 3 or 4%, and for African-American or Hispanic-owned firms, it's tiny. It's 1 or 2% maybe, depending on the data. Yeah. And then if you look at women, and I know this data more because it's where I spend most of my time, only 2% of women-owned businesses ever make more than $1 million in revenue. And so they're not creating jobs and growing at the rate that their male counterparts are. And I know this is a really long answer, but I'm also thinking about diverse suppliers and our commitment as a company. We spend $4 billion with a B with small women and minority-owned firms. And guess what? 50 or so of them every year graduate out of the program because they've grown on the back of Dell's investment in them, and they're no longer small. They're medium. And we hope they become large over time. So it's no one thing, but if diversity is always part of your business strategy and you're empowering your leaders to do what they can in their own areas of responsibility, then you start to see that change things over time.
Yeah, and I'm interested, I mean, because my interest is cognitive diversity, you know, bringing different perspectives to bear so that you reduce your collective blind spot, I care about all types of diversity. And I think that the same interventions that you need to think about gender diversity, you need them in spades. You need even more when you're thinking about other types of diversity.
And so we kind of doubled down on women because it's a global issue.
It's easy because you can see whether it's countable, it's measurable. Yeah. You have companies publishing on it, you know, the stats on their boards and so forth. But it doesn't mean that it's more important than any other type of diversity.
Hopefully that helped answer your question a little bit.
We've got a question there, and then we'll come back to this side, and then we'll go back to that side.
My name is Frances Fisher, and I think HR does a good job of trying to bring in a diverse audience. You mentioned that you have a co-part that helps you with your weaknesses. One of the things that places that I feel like we really struggle is it's easy to work with people who are like you,
right,
and it's hard to work with people who are different from you, and how you create an environment where people who are a little bit different can succeed and stick around, and just kind of thoughts on that, because I think we get people potentially either to the door or in the door, but then don't necessarily kind of have them for a longevity.
I can't stress enough the importance of this MARC training I talked about earlier. I would strongly recommend you go to Catalyst's website and look at Men Advocating for Real Change, understanding your unconscious bias so that you can individually drive that behavior change is critically important. There's no program that the company can start. There's no dollar investment that we can make. If the individual leaders in the company aren't representing the brand the way you want them to, and they aren't creating the culture inside the company that will keep that diverse talent. And we all know in big companies, it all comes down to your manager. Dell's a great place to work if you have a great manager, and if you have a sucky manager, it's kind of not so good. And then you got to find a new manager, or sometimes you can't get to that critical talent before it's too late. And the managers that are that middle level that are really also critical, because all employees, the way they value getting information the most is from their direct line manager. Yeah.
I also think you can teach managers to have better quality team conversations, so or better quality meetings. You know, for example, there's some, it's almost hygiene around making sure that everybody in the room has spoken. And sometimes that can feel a bit hokey, but if you say, okay, let's hear from the people who haven't spoken, and you actually draw out the perspectives. If you say, okay, so we've got an idea on the table everyone seems to be in favor of, let's hear from everybody one reason why this might fail. And you go around and you hear from every single person. Or the other way around, if everyone's bagging on an idea, okay, let's just wait and let's pull out what's one thing about this that we like that we want to save as an idea. And the more that you apply a bit of structure to thinking about how you bring out the different perspectives, the easier it is to make sure you're getting all sorts of diverse perspectives in the room. And you don't have to do anything complicated in order to teach managers how to do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hello.
Hi.
My name is Sunday, and I actually work at a small nonprofit, but I wanted to, the question or the subject I wanted to bring up is connecting two things that you guys had talked about. Initially, when you came on, you talked about innovation and kind of having the numbers and the data, and I'm a data and evaluation person, and bringing that up and bringing that to leadership and saying, this is what I want to do, and here's how it's borne out with the data. Yeah. But some of the other things you talked about was you need to be in a space where you feel confident and where you feel safe. Mm-hmm. If you look at what we were talking about in terms of people being able to sponsor you, a lot of times when you come to the table with something like that and people don't connect to you, you're too other from them.
Yeah.
So I'll be a woman or an African American or a Latina. And when I come up and say something and show the numbers, usually it's to change or fix or improve something, you can get to be seen as a troublemaker.
Yeah.
And that doesn't get you far in terms of being seen as a leader or effective in your work. And it also gets you branded as a person who we don't want to sponsor because you're not in our circle. So my question would be, if there are one or two things you could do to pitch or orient that so that when you're coming in with those things, you're taken at your word with good, that you have good faith and you are the team player. It's just that you don't see me on your team.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think it's a great point, and it comes up a lot. People trying to build relationships with senior folks who are not at all like them on the surface, and how do you build that connection? You want to talk about sports? You know, I've known some women kind of get really into sports that they really care nothing at all about in order that they can have a conversation. What I always, what I found worked for me, and also that I've seen work for a lot of women that I've coached and mentored, is you can't necessarily manufacture a connection. But the more you can show that you're excited and interested in something that they are doing and say, how can I help? And how can I get involved? That's actually good, even if the person is a cookie cutter copy of you. But it's especially helpful if the person is really difficult to find that point of connection. Because we know that people are drawn to people who look like themselves. That's something that psychologists call in-group. We know that we are more likely to feel empathy for someone that we categorize as being in our in-group. It really matters to find that point of contact. And that point of contact can be a shared interest. I am interested in the work that you do. I can still remember some of my early, boldest sort of shaping conversations when I was a young consultant were reaching out to people I didn't know at all who were doing something interesting, senior people in the firm. And it was in the day of voicemail, and I would kind of re-record the voicemail multiple times, you know, like trying to get it right. And then, you know, I'd say, I've heard that you're working on XYZ, and I think it sounds really interesting, and if you ever need an extra pair of hands, I'd like to put my hat in the ring. And that sort of also plays on our tendency to like reciprocity. So if I'm willing to give something, I'm more likely to get support. Mm-hmm. So that's a technique that I've often talked about using for people who are very different. What do you think?
Yeah, and it's important to understand the difference between a mentor and a sponsor. In my experience, a sponsor absolutely cannot be manufactured at all. That trust is earned through time and business experience. So, you know, when I was working on getting promoted to executive, for example, when it was time, I had a couple of people that I went to help me. I had worked with them years before, and I knew they trusted me, and I knew that they would give me good advice to guide me through the process. But I couldn't have gone to them 5 years before that because there was no relationship and they didn't have a reason to trust me or want to sponsor me. So I think you will know who your sponsors are early on, and then you just want to cultivate those relationships over time. But then when it comes to big ideas and going in backed up with the number and trying to drive change, to me, a troublemaker is someone who just comes to the table with the problems and doesn't have any idea on how to fix them. If you come in and say, look, I see this happening, this is what I'd like to do about it, can I take this on? I don't know what manager wouldn't want to say yes to
that's
that.
That's interesting. It's the last bit there.
It's
Can
the
I take this
bar.
On?
Yeah,
I have an
absolutely.
Idea. Yeah.
So I want to, I know we're running out of time and we want to get to this last question, but when we started the Dell Women's Entrepreneur Network, it was 2010. We were in the middle of a global recession. Our small business customers were coming to us asking for alternative lines of credit because their banks were turning them down. Steve Felice, who Melissa and I worked for at the time, was my boss, and we worked together in serving the needs of our small and medium-sized business customers, and we saw this problem. Then we started digging in, and we looked at the data, and we saw more women were asking for help than men. So I essentially came forward with our team and my boss at the time, and we said, look, we want to go launch this Dell Women's Entrepreneur Network to give women access to capital, to technology, and to networks, because they don't have it and they need it. Can we go pilot this? Will you give us the money? And let's go see if we can figure it out. And we brought 75 women from 10 countries and a bunch of global media together to have a conversation about this. But it was 100% anchored in a business problem. We had a very unique idea of one way to go about it that gave us brand lift for the company, and we hope over time made us more revenue. But it was a very soft sell, and we're 8 years into this program, and it's still going strong, and we're turning these women into customers and into suppliers to Dell, and we hope they're also getting what they need to grow their companies and contribute
so
through job
creation.
Coming
with a solution.
Coming with a solution, and
yeah.
not just saying, well, let's go run the same sales play over and over, because that must work. That's what we've always done. And
let's,
so that's one example.
Let's make time for the last question.
Yes.
So it's an easy question, but you've been talking a lot about cognitive biases and building out your teams of full of diversity. So what tips do you have when conducting an interview to identify people that think differently and make sure that you're being open-minded about somebody that's different than you that would be an asset?
Yeah, I was spending time with Iris Burnett yesterday. He's written What Works, the book that you might have heard of that's... Is applying behavioral science to making institutional changes in a company to boost diversity. And you know, her argument would be absolutely, you have to do it blind. You have to do it blind. And she's doing a bunch of tests rolling out this approach. Some of you might have heard the story about orchestras, certain orchestras, I mean, very few female players, 5%, then you put the auditions behind a curtain and the number jumps to 25% instantly when people can't see. Oh, they actually had to change the setup because they could hear the heels. So they actually had to have it on carpet so that people couldn't hear the heels because initially it didn't get the results that they were expecting. So, yes, the more that you can make processes as structured as possible, the less you focus on things that can't really be pinned down, the more that you can make things as factual as possible, all the evidence suggests that you get a less biased assessment process as a result. And you know, it can be a bit challenging to design, but a lot of companies are working on this right now, mm-hmm. so I'm quite optimistic that there'll be progress.
Mm-hmm. I think it also goes back to the basics. We've been talking a long time about making sure you have even a diverse pool to start with. And the way we get business done is I call up Melissa and I go, I need to hire someone. You know anybody? And so you just have to be aware of that. So it starts way before you even get into the interview process, but then you add that on top of it, and hopefully over time it starts to drive more change.
Yeah. Well, we've got a message saying stop now. So we are... Do you know, before, when I saw the title of this session, it's quite a mouthful. It's like innovation, diversity, teamwork, collaboration. It's just everything that sounded good, just all piled in. So often when I'm preparing for something like this, I kind of type into Amazon just to see what comes up. I type those four words in, and it said, no results. But it said, you might be interested in this. And the this was a men's skateboarding shoe. So I think that we're doing good work in filling that void. Thank you all for
listening
to us. And thank you, JJ, for being here.